was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood. When blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. This is Reservations, and I'm Rain Whalen.
And I'm Squidward Tennis Balls.
This way again, you can rest assured. I'll always do my best for her.
Are you like his cousin, Squilliam Fancy Bottom?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I just I was talking with Haley and she was just giving me suggestions. That was one of them, and I liked it. So,
Squidward Tennis Balls.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it almost sounds like a character that could exist in SpongeBob because, again, his cousin, Squilliam Fancy Bottom. Or is it Fancy Bottom, Squilliam Fancy Bottom, or Squilliam? I know it's Squilliam, which is the funniest thing in the world to me.
It's Squilliam Fancy Son.
Squilliam Fancy,
Fancy
Son.
Fancy Son. Oh, okay. So I didn't have the right verb, adjective, noun, whatever.
Yeah, that was the voice of one of our producers. I apologize.
We're just going to start crediting Haley as of the producer.
Maybe the cats too, if they pipe up, you know. Like, sorry, that was
we'll just give Haley a mic because you know all the
one
producers,
of our sound engineers in the booth, sorry about that.
In the oh god. Well, welcome back everyone. So buddy, we did a virtual hangout sesh the other day.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. For my birthday, you know, Ashley kind of gave me the idea while we were at Disney because she asked me what I wanted to do with for my birthday. And I was like, I don't know, you know, because this year my birthday fell on a Sunday, which relative to this recording was yesterday.
Also, Super Bowl.
It was just weird. And it was also the Super Bowl. So I had to compete with that. You know, that was fun. But, you know, I was just like, I don't know. I don't know what to do. And she was like, well, you know, we could, you know, we can invite the old gang for a hangout sesh virtually. I was like, yeah, you know, we could do that. And so I spent like 3 days researching how to get my PlayStation through Discord. That way we can all see like the screen.
Yeah.
Because I know we did that for New Year's 1 year, I think, when we all got sick. I don't remember. But I couldn't remember how we did it. So I was just like,
right. Yeah, you know, and it worked pretty well. I think there were just some like minor sound issues. Other than that, it was fine. It was fun. And I cannot believe it works. Like the Jackbox like worked from, you know, hundreds of miles away.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That was pretty crazy.
Yeah, I thought for sure, I was like, man, it's because, so I was using a thing called Remote Play, which is thankfully an app that Sony makes. And sometimes it's really choppy depending on the game, but I was like, man, it's going to cut out in the middle of one of these games and someone's going to lose a turn or something like that. And yeah, I was like, cool. I'm glad it worked. But speaking also, we were kind of talking about this off mic. Speaking of my birthday, yesterday competing with the Super Bowl, the only good thing that came out, which is what we were talking about, is we got the Deadpool 3 trailer.
Yeah.
Or should I say the Deadpool and Wolverine trailer? It looks awesome, man. It's gonna be
looks like fun. Definitely looks like fun. You know, it still seems to be, you know, the Fox Deadpool. You know, it doesn't seem to be watered down, at least not to me, but we'll see.
Well, Disney did say that they were willing to keep Deadpool rated R. And they also did they kind of did a test of a PG-13 Deadpool with Once Upon a Deadpool.
Oh, yeah.
Where they just took the second movie, removed all the blood, all the F-bombs, and then tried to see if that would work, and critics hated it, even though I enjoyed it just because the meta joke of Deadpool kidnapping Fred Savage to recreate the story time from Princess Bride. It was gold. But yeah, I'm excited for Deadpool and Wolverine. It's gonna be so good, man. Although Ashley was already like trying to like theorize like the TVA, you know. If anyone finished, did you finish Loki season 2?
Yeah.
Okay, great. You know, there's like all those questions now. It's like, wait, with how Loki season 2 ended, like how, like why this TVA looks kind of like how it did before Loki showed up and like fixed it, quote unquote, you know? So I don't know. July cannot get here fast enough, man. Which is insane, because also, as we were talking about off mic, that's the only Marvel, I think, anything that's coming out this year.
Yeah.
I don't think we're getting a new show this year, and that's the only movie that's coming out.
I mean, but that's fine. You know what I mean? I think we're due for a break. Not that I've been watching barely any of it, but if those who do, you know, it's nice to get a break from all of that and, you know, go outside.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. I mean, technically Echo did come out this year, but like they released that all in its entirety, you know?
Right.
So, but, yeah, I'm excited. Can't wait to see, it looks awesome.
It looks so fun for sure.
Yeah. But anyway, but that's not what we're talking about today. Jeremy, no, should I remind everyone?
Yeah.
I was about to say, should I remind everyone? So in case you missed last week, this week we are talking about the 2015 biopic written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by Danny Boyle, Steve Jobs. This one came out, if memory serves, right around the time of the Ashton Kutcher one, right? Jobs. So
Jobs was 2013. This one was 2015. So a couple years apart. And I mean, definitely superior to Jobs.
For sure. For sure. I mean, look, I think the reason why I thought they were so close together, because I watched them back to back.
Okay.
So yes, I'd seen this movie before I picked it. If you missed last week, this was meant to be sort of a surprise for you, because I know how big a fan you are of Aaron Sorkin and Danny Boyle. Yeah. So I'd seen the movie before, because I kind of went through this this big phase of wanting to know as much as I could about Steve Jobs, because here's a little bit about me that most people probably don't know. You know, but I'm sure Zach, our listener, doesn't know. I used to work for an Apple authorized retailer, and so I was trained by Apple. I just didn't work directly for Apple, and I worked there for 3 years. And so there was a period of my life when I was working there that I was like obsessed with Steve Jobs, and I needed to know everything I could about Steve Jobs. And so I watched Jobs with Ashton Kutcher, which on the whole, it's a fine movie. You know, it's very formulaic biopic. Ashton, I think he did a good job, you know.
I agree.
And then I saw this one. Oh.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
You're good.
Yeah.
So then I saw this one, and like you just said, yeah, vastly superior. I think, even though Michael Fassbender doesn't really look like Steve Jobs, which I'm sure a lot of people, you know, viewing this as a biopic was like, well, he doesn't look like him. As I kind of teased last week, I feel like Fassbender really captured Steve's essence, because I have heard that he was a really intense person, and and that's putting it lightly.
Definitely.
So, Jeremy, when was the first time you saw this movie, if you can remember?
Man, I'm almost positive I saw it in theaters.
Okay.
Because, you know, it was Aaron Sorkin, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously I was a huge fan of Fassbender also. So, I'm almost positive I saw it in theaters. And I loved it. I thought it was awesome. I am so, so enthralled with the way that Sorkin writes. He writes in such a way that forces people to speak a certain way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is unique in terms of writing, because it's sort of like the way Lanthimos says that he doesn't tell like his actors to speak like in that sort of monotone way, or that sort of apathetic sort of way that they do in The Lobster and in Killing of a Sacred Deer. It's just sort of just like naturally what you do when you're going off of the script, or you're going off of the direction, or you're going off of just the tone of what you think that the film should be. In this case, it's sort of like Sorkin just writes fast, furious dialogue. And so you have mm-hmm. to speak in a certain cadence in a certain way to get out all that dialogue. And it's really fascinating to watch like people's interpretations of his writing. Cause like in The West Wing, it's sort of like this. And then in Moneyball, it's something very similar to this. And then the Social Network, of course, is a good example. And
I forgot he wrote The Social Network.
A Few Good Men and even Molly's Game. Right. It's just inherent in the way that he writes and the way that he wants people to interact, the characters to interact, because it's a lot of just talking over one another, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what I've categorized as something that I think Sorkin excels in is he excels in smart people being smart, is my sort of, layman's way of putting it. If you've seen The West Wing, if you've seen The Newsroom, if you've seen, you know, Molly's Game, Social Network, right, Moneyball, like these are smart people being smart in what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
People are experts at what they're doing, and they are showcasing their expertise, right?
Yeah.
And I love it. And in this case, in this unique case, and also a little bit with Social Network, but less so, is that this is sort of historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess this is a good way to segue into the synopsis, and I'll take care of it this time. Since you did it last time, I think. So,
did I? Oh, yes. Yeah, I did.
So Steve Jobs, so this film takes place during three separate product launches. You have the Macintosh, you have the Next, and then you have the iMac. Okay. It's 1984, it's 1988, and it's 1998.
Yes.
And Jobs is always in conflict. He's always having to solve problems. He is talking and in conflict with the same five or six people in each of these product launches. And you can see the character growth. You can see the development within their characters, right? And how they evolve over these 14 years. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why this is historical fiction is none of this happened the way that you see that it does, right? Steve Jobs didn't talk to John Sculley each product launch. He didn't see Andy Hertzfeld every time. Steve Wozniak wasn't there, right? But for us to understand who these people are and how they are in relation to one another and who they are in their social dynamics and just how they interact with problem solving and just, again, the essence of who they are, this was a wonderful showcase for that. And it's not really revisionist history because Sorkin's not saying this is fact, right? We're not at the end. We're not showing pictures of Steve Jobs next to Michael Fassbender, right? We're not doing, you know, Wozniak with Seth Rogen. Like, we're not doing that, right?
Yeah.
There's even hints along the way to future Apple products, you know, like they're Easter eggs, right?
Yeah.
Which is fun. But again, none of this happened, but the core of who these people are is absolutely true. Wozniak, I watched an interview with him, and he was saying that, and I flubbed the quote from last week. But he said none of it happened, but essentially he's like, he did say none of it happened, but it's all true, but it's none of it happened, but that's the way it would have gone down if that's how it would have went down, because he captured the essence of who these people are, right? Mm-hmm. And he had absolutely no problem with it. And, you know, he actually liked that Seth Rogen played him, and he liked that how he was playing him, because he said, I would never call Steve Jobs an asshole, ever. I would never speak to him the way that Seth Rogen does in the movie, but it shows that conflict, and it shows the dichotomy between the two of them, and it shows how passionate they are about their beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And their ideologies and their philosophies and how things should be done. And Sorkin captures that perfectly. So,
yeah. And what's that, your synopsis?
Yeah. Terrible. Went off the
rails. It was great. It was great. I completely agree. Because like I mentioned at the top of the show, Steve Jobs sort of became like it became a hyper fixation of mine for a few months. And, you know, and I love that inner cut with how Sorkin wrote how it could have gone down. We do get fact, you know, we do know that the fact that, which again, it is true, the Macintosh did fail, that Steve was fired out of Apple. John Sculley was one of the reasons for that. That then Steve went on to make Next, and then Next was a failure, and then desperate for something, they brought Steve back, and Steve saved Apple, and then there we go.
Yeah.
But I love that. Yeah, because like exactly what you said, that Sorkin captured who these people are, you know, because yes, I don't think I've seen that exact interview, but I have seen interviews with Steve Wozniak, and you know, Steve, you know, the Woz and Jobs, from everything I've gathered from what Wozniak has said, is that, you know, they were like brothers, that they loved one another. You know, Wozniak loved, you know, Jobs. I'm sure they didn't agree on things, but I do like that, you know, Sorkin took that and just kind of cranked it up to 11, you know, with the whole, you know, when people ask me about Steve Jobs now, I say he's an asshole. Like that's perfect.
Yeah.
You know,
and again,
oh, go ahead.
Steve Wozniak said he would never, ever say that to him. Right. This is not how he is. That's not how he is. Right. Mm-hmm. But he understood and understands that for that scene to work and for the conflict to be sort of showcased, that needs to be there, right? And that needs to be reflected within the character, even though it's not really like him, but it's how it feels, right?
Yes.
And even the Apple II thing, where he's like, you're not acknowledging the Apple II, right? And that becomes a, you know, a 14-year thing, right? He said it came up once in a meeting. He did not acknowledge the Apple II, you know, and we left it at that. I mean, that was it. But again, that was a moment in time where he felt that Steve Jobs was ignoring the past to focus on the future. And that's a part of who Jobs is. And so we're going to take that and we're going to flesh it out a little bit, and we're going to expand upon it to showcase that part of Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
Which I thought was brilliant. Also, like the Christine and Lisa thing, like that's also true, right? Did it happen just like that? No, of course not. Right. Did he see Christine, you know, at these launches, and did he have that exact argument? No. But did he do that blood test, and did he say that that it was like the 12%
like men? 28%. Yeah.
Yeah, he did. He did say that. And that was, yeah, that was public. That was publicized, and that was real. Right.
Yeah. The only thing in the film, because I was watching the behind the scenes, even Sorkin said this, the only thing in the film that is exactly the way it happened is the opening of the movie when they're trying to get the Macintosh to say hello.
Yeah.
Like everything after that, that's all, you know, fictionalized. And, you know, and we were kind of, I think we were talking about this with Blonde just amongst ourselves. Or I think I was watching that video that you'd sent me about Blonde. And there's something about fictionalizing, you know, a real life event. It adds so much to not only the person, but I feel like the moment in time, you know, because it, I don't know, like I didn't feel like I was watching a biopic. Like,
because you're not, felt, right? Because even Sorkin said that, you know, this isn't a, I think he said a crib to grave, right? Or it's it's not one of those, right? Like, we're not going to go and hit every point of it. Like, we're doing this in a 3-act structure. We're doing it in product launches, right? Yes, it's a 14-year period. That's a substantial amount of time, but we're not going to touch on like these moments, you know, in the traditional stereotypical way a biopic does. I like that, you know, when he's arguing with Steve Wozniak, you know, about, you know, this argument began in the garage, and then we do get a flashback to them in the garage, right? That's cool. You know, I like that. We get a little bit of that, that sort of humble beginnings, right?
Yeah.
But it's just for a few moments, and then we're back to the product, right? We're back to the product launch, you know? Jobs. Now, something that I know for a fact is also correct is the record player that he has in his house. That was his record player. The reason I know that, sorry, my cats are fighting and I'm going to kill them. I'm so sorry. They're making so much noise. I apologize. So sorry. Oh, anyway. So the only reason I know what kind of record player he had is Joseph Gordon-Levitt had the same one in Looper. And it's the coolest looking thing, right? It's kind of futuristic. I don't know. It's really cool. It's got these spheres underneath it that spin with the turn. It's so cool looking. Anyway, I was talking. I it was like the part of the trivia for Looper was that was the kind of turntable Steve Jobs had, and they put it in his apartment or house or wherever he was, in one of the flashbacks. And so I like that. But anyway, so meaning that they're still nitpicking little things that are known about Jobs, or, you know, we can put real things in here, of course, because we're not out to fictionalize everything, right?
Right.
Him sticking his feet in the toilet, that's real, right? He used to do that to calm down. I don't know how or why. Don't understand it at all. I think it's super weird. But Fassbender, you know, when he was doing his research, was like, hey, Jobs used to do this. I think we should put it in there.
Well, and, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is a good segue to the filming part of the story. But before I do that, I wanted to add something to what you said about, you know, they are putting real world things in it. Danny Boyle said this in the behind the scenes, which is, you know, he didn't want to make a normal biopic because he said that the whole time you feel like you're looking over your shoulder. Like, oh, does it match? Does it match what we know? And he was like, and it's never going to be that. And he's like, so I didn't want to make that kind of movie. So I'm glad that Aaron didn't write that kind of movie. But anyway, I just wanted to add that. So good segue over to the production that they had. I think it was 4 weeks of rehearsal per act.
Mm-hmm.
And Kate Winslet, who is just phenomenal.
She's great.
Was saying how Michael, especially when they were rehearsing the 1998 stuff, was just really experimenting, like the part where Steve does yoga. Michael experimented with that in rehearsal and it worked. And so they're like, do it when we start rolling.
Yeah.
And so I feel like the whole feet in the toilet thing was probably him like, hey, I read that he did this. Let me try it. And they're like, sure.
It's one of those things that I just flat out just don't understand. You know what I mean? Like there's some things that I'm like, it's weird, but I get it because of this, but that, I can't explain that away at all. But you're right. Having that time to rehearse and you know, put things in or take things out or whatever, you know, and especially that each one is in real time, really puts you in the pressure cooker also of the situation, right? Because each one of these acts has a ticking clock, right?
Yep.
Which is, it's this time, the launch starts in about 38 minutes, right? And so when they're trying to put out fires or problem solve, it's that much more heightened, right? We get a few moments of levity where, like when Steve Jobs, when he gets in the elevator in the first act, you finally get to breathe. It's like your first time that you realize that, oh, I've been on edge for the past 20 minutes, you know?
Yes. Since the movie started. Yeah.
I didn't even realize that I've been, you know, so anxious. And then he gets in the elevator and I'm like, okay. And then as soon as that elevator door opens, we're back at it. Right.
Yeah.
And he has that moment where he looks at the boxes of the Time magazine. Yeah. Which, man, what a great callback in the third act, you know, where it's like, it was a sculpture. You were never going to be Man of the Year.
Yeah.
They would have commissioned it well ahead of time. Right.
Yeah. Well, which again, as you were talking about, shows the character growth in the 14 years since the movie started to now. You know, especially, man, it's another really good segue to the character growth with John Scully at the IMAC launch, you know, because, you know, when we first see them at the Macintosh launch, like him and Steve are really close, they're friends. And then when we go to the next launch, they're at each other's throats, which there was, I believe there was rumors that I believe John Scully was not in part responsible, but he was instrumental in getting Steve ejected from Apple during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of rumors that Steve held a lot of animosity towards John. But I love that we got to kind of get to see a fictionalized version of that.
Yeah.
And John saying, you know, you're going to come after me, aren't you? And Steve just so almost villainous with the whole, no, I'm going to watch Center Court. I'm going to sit Center Court and watch you do it to yourself. And just like, oh. But then in 1998, we see sort of like a reconciliation, you know, of, you know, Steve sort of forgiving him and, you know, especially love the line, like, did I cause this? Did I do this? You know, showing that he's looked back in the last 14 years, seeing he, at least in this version in the film, he sort of forced John's hand and getting him expelled from the company.
You know, which is interesting and sort of like it's that is revisionist history, because he never spoke to John Scully again. Like, that did not happen in 1998.
I think when he was let go from Apple, he burned all bridges with John Scully.
He never talked to him. I mean, that's so crazy. But, you know, again, Sorkin is the sort of writer that's like, people are going to want reconciliation. People are going to want character growth, right? That's what we're building towards, right? We're building towards character arc, and we need that, right? We need to show him not really getting softer, but him being a little bit more empathetic and a little more understanding and a little bit more willing to be wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we show that? Well, we can have him reconcile with John Scully. It's never happened, right?
Yeah.
But again, it's a good way to show this character. Again, like, this may be one of the best ways to do a biopic, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. Again, because this, again, isn't a biography, because again, it's not cradle to grave.
And I like what Sorkin said, you know, because it is technically based on the Steve Jobs autobiography by Walter Isaacson.
Yeah.
But I like what Eric Sorkin said about, quote unquote, adapting that, which was, Walter took sort of a journalistic approach to writing the biopic, or writing the autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And Sorkin said, I'm not a journalist.
Yeah.
I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And so, and I think that's, again, why this just works so well. Are they still fighting?
Oh, she's whining. I don't know if you guys can hear that.
Now I can.
Yeah, she can get pretty loud. So sorry, everybody listening. But yeah, you're absolutely right that he's not a journalist. He's a writer, and he, you know, this is what he does, right? And so, like, and again, like, I commend Steve Wozniak for saying in that interview, he's saying, you know, like, I didn't read the script. I would have never, because it's not my job to say this didn't happen, this didn't happen, this didn't happen. Right.
Mm-hmm.
He wants an artist interpretation of the story. Right. And again, commendable, because I think a lot of other people would have said this didn't happen, this didn't happen. Right.
Yeah, you know, this is sort of a sidebar, but, you know, we have seen, you know, in recent years with biopics getting hate for, you know, the, maybe someone who wasn't asked or something like that. You know, I really want to see Sofia Coppola's Priscilla.
Mm-hmm.
And Ashley found a review from, I think it was Lisa Marie before she passed away, which is, she didn't like the film. She felt like they were kind of ganging up on her dad. But in the context of that film, it wasn't about her dad. It was about her mom.
Right.
And so I think, but the point I'm making is that, you know, I agree with you. I think Woz could have stepped in and could have said, no, that's not what happened. But I think you're right. I think he knew, okay, this is their interpretation of it. And also, kind of like what you already said, I think he, you know, having Seth come and talk to him, I think kind of put his mind at ease.
Well, as well. Again, I think that it's the way most biopics are structured.
Mm-hmm.
They are structured as sort of dramatized documentaries.
Right.
Which is not, you know, which leads to more criticism, in my opinion, because you're going to look for things to be fact, right? Mm-hmm. And things to be how they were, which is why I think Moneyball really works, and why The Social Network really works, because we're not doing a traditional thing. We're not, you know, I think with all three of these, they're all fact checkable, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they're all very highly publicized events, right? The winning streak of the Oakland A's, that is more than highly publicized. That was shown on television, right? while it was happening. It's a sporting event, right? So it's all checkable. And so to do it in this more artistic interpretationist way, which is probably not a word, is really interesting. And when done in this way, in sort of this new, this different structure, that you're not going to be looking for some of that, you know, you're not going to be looking for, you know, oh, that's not, you know, that's not what happened, or, you know, he didn't go to that public school, or whatever, you know, like the growing up stuff. It's like, that didn't really happen. Or, you know, they're embellishing this or embellishing this. If it's all embellished, then there's nowhere, to go, you know?
Yeah.
If it's all made up, or if it's all, if it's all stylized for the focus of the character, then really the only criticism in that regard is, did you get the person right? And I think they did.
Yeah. You know, and I'm going to cite another biopic, one that I know you and I both like, Rocket Man. I think Rocket Man did a really good job by playing kind of fast and loose with Elton John's timeline, by never showing a date on screen, having it be a musical and having certain songs that maybe he wrote later in his career be performed at the beginning of his career. So you kind of don't know what's going on.
Well, and it's musical and logic also, which is fun, you know, so it's way hyper stylized.
Yeah. So yeah, that's another one I think left out. You know, there's little room for criticism, but of course Elton also was heavily involved in the film and, you know, pretty much said go crazy. Yeah. You know, so but kind of going circling back, there was one bit that I was kind of curious about if anyone, you know, had something to say about the film, because I was kind of, when I was rewatching it last night, for some reason I was kind of reminded of what you told me when we did Raging Bull, which is when I forgot his name, the guy that De Niro plays,
Jake LaMotta,
when he, I remember you saying when we did that episode, which shout out to our Raging Bull episode, he asked his ex-wife, was I really like that? And she said, no, you were worse. For some reason, that kept like coming back into my head while I was rewatching it. And I wanted to find if Lisa Brennan Jobs, if she had anything to say about the movie. I couldn't find anything. Although I did sort of see like an article where she, like when I Googled it, like the little preview of the article made it seem like she thought the movie was great and just like what Waz said, captured her dad perfectly. But when I clicked on the link, it brought up a different article about the movie where it didn't have any of that listed. So I would assume, you know, she probably enjoyed the film, especially considering, you know, so many people have said that Steve was that intense. But something else that I'd never realized about the movie until I finished it last night and I started watching the behind the scenes and reading more about the film is, and it kind of contradicts what we've been saying, not really contradicts, it kind of undermines what we've been doing, what we've been talking about, but the movie is essentially a story of a father and a daughter.
Sure. I think that's one of the main character arcs of Steve Jobs is his willingness to step up and be a father, right? Or to acknowledge that he even has one.
In case anyone didn't know, Steve famously, as Jeremy already said, denied for years that Lisa was ever his actual daughter. Even though a blood test confirmed it, he still tooth and nail denied it until I think about the 90s when he finally started accepting her and trying to be a father, which we see in the third act of the film. But yeah, I really picked up on that, that this is really, because it starts off, you know, he, at the beginning, in Act 1, he doesn't really care to have her around. You know, Chrisanne is definitely just kind of using her for leverage, at least in his eyes. And then by 88, he doesn't mind talking to her, you know, when she's measuring the cube. And she's like, well, it isn't off. Like, what are you talking about? It's not off. And then getting some advice from Joanne, like, you know, when she does that, she's scared. Ask her about what she's interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And then by 98, they have sort of, I mean, there's still a fight between them, but he's fully embraced. I am your father. I'm going to do whatever I can for you. You know, I didn't name Lisa the Lisa because of this. It was named after you. Of course it was named after you, you know, which is just so interesting that underneath all of this is that through line of a story of a father and a daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. I also really like, so that was, you know, there are consistencies with each one, right? Many within each act, right? One of them is the newspaper writer or the magazine writer, or
Joel.
John Orwitz's character. I like that. I like that that's a sort of a consistency, which again, not real. But I like that. It, you know, it's you know, he encompasses the public perception of Steve Jobs and where that comes from, and what he sees is whatever Steve Jobs wants him to see, right? Mm-hmm. So I really like that. I also really like just again, there's the unrealistic thing of him running into the same people at each launch. One of them is Andy Hertzfeld, yeah. Played by Michael Stahlberg, who as
yeah, shout you know, out, shout yeah. out to our boy Michael Stahlberg.
Yes, we love Michael Stahlberg on the show.
Yeah.
And yeah, his Andy Hertzfeld is so good. And in that, again, the thing with the Andes, cause Sarah Snook, those of you,
yeah.
I, of course, you know, it's Predestination and it's Succession for me, for Sarah Snook.
You know, what's kind of funny. Speaking of Sarah Snook, even though she was in this film with Seth Rogen, they were never, I mean, I think they were in a few scenes together, but I don't think they like acted opposite one another.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did An American Pickle on Max where they play, husband and wife.
Oh,
yeah.
That's fine. She's Andrea Cunningham. They call her Andy. And so there's that running joke where it's like, you know,
yep. Andy. Where's Andy? Hertzfeld, and it's usually always Hertzfeld
because he's always gonna yell Hertzfeld.
Yeah, but I love in the 98 story where he's all like, oh, where Joel goes, oh, Andy told me to come back. Which one? Cunningham. We've got to figure out a new name for them. I'm like, well, yeah, you call Cunningham Andrea. No, I know who I'm talking about, but like, we need a new name for everyone else.
Yeah. I know, you know, this movie's great. But I like that you brought up Blonde earlier.
Uh-huh.
Blonde gets a lot of criticism, okay? Whether or not it's founded is obviously up for interpretation. I love Blonde personally. I think it's wonderful. I think it's awesome. I think it's tragic, and you know, it's great. I
agree. Kind of what we've been saying with Steve Jobs. I think what Andrew Dominik did with that really captured the tragedy of Marilyn Monroe.
Right, I think that one is more, they see it as exploitation of Marilyn Monroe, mm-hmm. right? It's sort of like beating a dead horse with,
right.
you know, her objectification and her, you know, being an object, basically, right? I think that mm-hmm. that's probably what most of the criticism is, right? And of course, some of it was, it didn't happen like that. And, you know, that book is famously historical fiction.
Okay? Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. it was never meant to be, you know, journalism. It was never meant to be, you know, precisely researched facts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, who knows? We may do Blonde in the future. I don't know. Which would be really
cool. we'll have to heavily tell people, like, hey, this episode is gonna like dive in deep on some hard topics.
Yeah, but where I think that would probably be the only difference, which is the perception of Blonde is exploitation,
mm-hmm.
and in doing more harm, right, to a public figure who was harmed enough, I think is probably the main criticism. Of that here, you know, where it doesn't seem that it didn't happen played a lot in any sort of criticism because it was very highly regarded. I mean, this movie did very well. And I think mm-hmm. it's because of how poorly the other one did.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, I mean, obviously, like when you get people like Danny Boyle and Sorkin, you know, it's already going to be great, I think. Or, you know, even if you don't like Sorkin, you know, you have Danny Boyle, right? Mm-hmm. Who, there are these choices being made where when Jobs is talking to Scully at the Macintosh launch and he's trying to decide on Bob Dylan lyrics and we're seeing them projected on the floor and on the ceiling and on the walls, right? That's really cool. And it's really stylized and it's not meant to be diegetic. And, you know, it's sort of just a representation of his thought process. And then we have the Skylab stuff on the wall during the next launch, which I really mm-hmm. liked. And again, not meant to be diegetic. It's a representation of his thoughts, right? His thought process. And mm-hmm. is it true? I don't know. The way that Sorkin writes and how he melds in fiction and fact, especially with The Newsroom, which again, I highly recommend everybody watch.
Which also has Jeff Daniels in it.
Yes. Jeff Daniels, I think, is one of our greatest working actors. Hands down.
Yeah.
It's not even close.
100%.
You know, is that Skylab story true? I would say probably.
You know, they also made a joke about it. Sorry, this is kind of off topic, but they also made a joke about it in Wet Hot American Summer.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. Yeah, when Janine Garofalo and David Hyde Pierce are doing their whole, like, dramatized, like, a piece of Skynet and it's like a giant satellite that crashes. Anyways.
Yeah, I think so. That's probably true. I mean, you know, I try not to take, like, I don't want to take what he's saying about Skylab and then regurgitate it to someone and then they'll be mm-hmm. like, that's not what happened, you know?
And you're just like, oh,
what do I say? I heard it in a movie, right? So
I learned it from a historical fiction film about Steve Jobs, and then you skitter off into the night.
Right. I'd like to think that it is. I didn't look it up or anything. I don't know a lot about or anything about Skylab, but I'd like to think that is true. Right. Aaron Sorkin likes to put in things like that, these monologues of tales of perseverance or triumph or tragedy or coincidence or circumstance. He likes to do that within his work. He did it in The West Wing all the time. He did it in The Newsroom all the time, where mm-hmm. Jeff Daniels would tell a story about once it was the Challenger explosion. And he talked about how one little thing and one little miscommunication or an unintended consequence led to the tragedy of the Challenger explosion. I talk about the O-rings and the weather and the unexpected, unnatural weather in Florida and how that led to the downfall of the Challenger. God, that's in season two. Again, highly recommend The Newsroom.
If most people don't know, for a while, a monologue that Jeff Daniels did about the state of America was getting passed around the internet like wildfire.
That's true.
It's a great monologue. It's a great good. Monologue, but I saw that on like three different.
I know, like, it was everywhere.
I think I saw it on like Facebook and. Yeah, it was everywhere.
It's not even the best part of the show. I mean, like, the show gets so much better from there, and I think people want to define it by the... And that's the opening of the pilot, of the first episode.
Really? So, when he's doing, like, a Q&A?
Yeah, that's how the show starts.
Oh, my God. It's holy shit.
That's how we're introduced to Will McAvoy, his character. And so... I'd like for people not to define it by that moment and by, you know, that clip, whether you agree with it or not. I think you should just watch the show regardless. But, you know, I don't remember where I was going with all of that. I just started fawning over the choices that Danny Boyle is making with the...
Yeah, that's pretty much what you're doing. Now, I do want to do this real quick. I want to just briefly... Just ever so briefly talk about the Ashton Kutcher Jobs film.
Okay. Which I've not seen. So.
Oh, you haven't? Okay. No. Well, you're not missing much. It's a by the numbers biopic. I mean, Ashton, he does an okay jobs. Okay. Job as Steve Jobs. I would say Fassbender did it better. I think Fassbender, as we've been saying, really captured the essence of Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Ashton just really captured him in looks and sort of like the boyish charm that people had in their heads of Steve Jobs. But anyway, the reason why I wanted to bring that up real quick is because the film opens in a really interesting way. Kind of like this one, where the film opens actually with, you know, an interview from, I'm assuming, the 50s.
About how
computing is going to go from these giant wall to wall, floor to ceiling cabinets to personal computing, you know, laptops, like how we're doing the show now, and all that kind of stuff. But Jobs opens with a quote unquote product launch as well, more so an internal launch of Steve, like, talking to the internal team about what they're going to announce. And, like, he's already in, you know, the black turtleneck, the jeans, the glasses. Mm. And the film opens with him pulling out the iPod. And then we flash back to Berkeley. Is that where Steve went? Berkeley?
No clue. It was just for a semester anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. But then we get flashback to the 70s, and then the movie goes on from there. And so it's interesting that, you know, that film doesn't really waste, like, it doesn't want to show us older Steve Jobs. Because the film ends with him meeting Johnny Ives, who was Steve's, like, right-hand man for design for quite a long time until he eventually left Apple in 2017. I think he left shortly after I think Tim Cook came on. But that's how the film ends, is him of them meeting and them designing the first iMac, which is how our movie ends. Is the unveiling of the iMac. Which, sidebar, can we bring back those designs, you know, those late 90s, like, see-through, clear designs?
Yeah.
Like, that was so cool. Like, why did we ever stop doing that?
Now, here's what's interesting in that you're bringing up the design of the iMac, right? That's that's another through line that goes with all of the sections and all the acts is his unwillingness to back down when it comes to what can you do with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a part of his control thing, right? Where he wants to be in control of every product and every product accessory, right? Because where Wozniak in the film version of Wozniak, which I'm sure was his real ideology because, again, it had to come from somewhere, is that people want to customize, people want to be able to do whatever they want with the machine, right? And Jobs is like, absolutely not. It needs to be incompatible with anything else, right? And so even with the iMac was pretty incompatible, even though it didn't have USB, right? It did have a CD drive. So with that, to me, that means that it's compatible with other things. But and of course, this was the internet boom as well. And so it actually got, you know, connected to the internet, things like that. But I thought that was so interesting that keeps being brought up, right? With each, with each section, which is, you know, he calls it end-to-end control, right? Which sums up how he feels about his business perfectly, I think. And I think that's on purpose that they chose this detail of each machine that is important to him, right?
Well, and you know, that's also something that Apple still kind of sticks with, you know. It still is not necessarily incompatible now, but it, you know, Macs and your iPhone and Apple Watch and iPad and everything else only really works within the Apple ecosystem, you know. Yes, you can technically customize now. Like if you're getting an iMac, you can special, like, you know, up the memory and up the storage and customize it the way you want to. But then once it's built, it's built. Like that's it. And I can see Steve's, I mean, again, I'm using this version of Steve. I can see his ideology about it, you know. Users, we need to make a product where a user can't change it. It needs to be the way it is. And then I can see Wozniak's side, the film version of Wozniak. Like, no, people want to customize, which I would say is about 50-50. Mm-hmm. You know, I like my Mac, I like my MacBook the way it is. I didn't want to customize it. But I mean, if I had the option, who knows what I would do. But yeah,
and it's in that instance that up until that point, Sorkin has been writing Jobs to end every argument with the last word, right? Like he is, his stubbornness and his unwavering sense of being right, you know, is always at the forefront. It's in this flashback where he doesn't get the last word, Woz does. You know, where he talks about, you know, I'm not giving this computer human flaws, especially not yours, right? Or whatever it was. And that was it. And so again, it's showing that instance of him willing to step back and be not wrong necessarily, but take a step back and realize that maybe Wozniak is right. You know, it doesn't happen very often. But I like that, right? It, you know, he hasn't always been so stubborn, right? He was, he used to be willing to back down, right? Or at least give someone else the opportunity to be right.
Right. Well, I wanted to talk about, something just real quick. Because there was a part in the film that I forgot about, and it's when he meets John Scully during the next launch. Mm-hmm. And also, I meant to say this earlier. We're not just saying the next launch, everyone. The product literally was called Next. N-E-X-T. Next. Anyway. And, you know, Scully says, you know, the myth of how I fired you is growing. And I never caught that the first time I watched the movie, but rewatching it last night, I kind of realized Sorkin was kind of onto something, you know, because there is sort of this mythology surrounding Steve Jobs as mm-hmm. a person, as, you know, because as, you know, Wozniak points out in the film, Steve isn't an engineer. He's not, you know, he has a very base level knowledge on computing. But, you know, as Woz says in the film, but you're hailed as a genius. Like, how does that make sense? And I don't know. I feel like Sorkin maybe wasn't tipping his, like, nodding to the audience, but saying, like, yeah, there is this mythology that surrounds Steve that has become bigger than the person, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's another reason why you and I like this movie so much, because they were trying to show the person, not the mythology. They're just trying to show him as a man.
Yeah, I think so, because we can even see real life examples of that influence of the myth of Steve Jobs. I think famously, or infamously, you could say the Elizabeth Holmes case. I don't know if you know who that is. She created the Theranos machine that would diagnose things with just a drop of blood, right? She ended up defrauding a whole bunch of people, and it wasn't true, and the technology just never caught up to what she wanted it to be. And, like, it's a whole thing. There's a great documentary about her on HBO. There's a series starring Amanda Seyfried where she plays
Elizabeth Holmes.
You know, she cites Steve Jobs as an influence in the way that she conducts her business, and even the way she dresses. She wears the exact same thing every single day because she heard that's what Steve Jobs used to do. Right. And so it's one less thing you have to worry about. It's one less thing you have to make a decision about, so you can have, you know, the bandwidth to make other more important decisions. Right. I don't know if that's true about Steve Jobs, but it doesn't matter because it's in the mythos. And you're exactly right.
Yeah. Well, and there's I was trying to find it. There's a documentary I saw a while back also that if you want to get more behind the man, you want to know the man that inspired the legend. There's a documentary called Steve Jobs, One Last Thing. Because that's how he would always end all his keynotes. Oh, and one last thing. And it would always be the big reveal. And it's a really good interview. That's where I learned about the whole him bankrolling Pixar, essentially. Mm-hmm. And him having that screaming argument with one of the Pixar heads. And also where I've learned that he was a very intense person. But, like, I just feel like, again, like I said with this, you know, they really just show the man. Like, they stripped away the mythos, and they just showed that he's just a flawed man trying to do what he believes in, I guess.
Yeah. And I do like the line that, you know, during that argument with Wozniak about, you know, him saying that you're not an engineer, you're not a designer, you have a basic, you know, knowledge of computers and engineering. And it's because he's like, you know, you play the violin, you're the best in your row, but I play the orchestra, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, I don't know, it with modern eyes, it's sort of like it's such a one percenter thing to say, because it's, you know, it's taking all the credit, you know, for work other people are doing.
Yeah. Well, and it's
what you could argue is what he did. I think I think that's obviously it's in there on purpose, and it's in there to sort of have the audience think like, well, you know, maybe he is just taking credit for the work that all these people are doing. And maybe, you know, I mean, is that right? You know?
Well, and, you know, and to bring it into modern times, you know, Tim Cook, the current CEO of Apple, kind of sort of does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not fully. I don't think not to the full extent, because I think he recognizes that if he did that, then, you know, people would probably criticize him for being like, oh, you're just trying to be, you know, Steve Jobs. But, you know, every new Apple announcement now always starts with Tim. Always goes back to Tim in between each segment. And then it always ends with Tim. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's kind of how Steve was. You know, I remember, I don't think I ever saw one of Steve's keynotes, but I did, you know, they're archived. People can find them out there. Steve kind of did the same thing, more or less, but more not letting other, I don't remember him bringing out other people onto the stage,
mm-hmm.
as where Tim lets the people in those departments talk.
I see.
Now, again, maybe that's just because Tim has no knowledge of computing. So it's like, I'm just going to let the person who actually knows everything speak, and I'll come in and with my two cents after the fact. I don't know. I don't know Tim Cook personally. I would like to, so I could ask him for a new MacBook. But I don't know. It seems like it's a trend.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the keynotes and the product launches. So in the very first one with the Macintosh, they have to, they sort of have to fake it, right? Because it can run on a higher, what is it, a higher processor or something. Like it's a,
I think they're referring to a higher processor. Yeah.
It can run on that, but it can't run on the one that they say it can, right? Which it can, they just needed to fix it, but they couldn't fix it. But they have this other thing that it will for sure run on. It'll be fine. Okay. So here's a fun fact for you. Something that I learned in, I think it was the, either the CNN Decades series, and it was either the 90s or the 2000 series, probably the 2000 series because it's an iPhone, or it was the Decades series on National Geographic. It doesn't matter. I love stuff like that. Either way, they were talking about the product launch for the iPhone. Okay. And yes, it worked. However, they had like 7 or 8 different iPhones. Each iPhone could only do one thing. And so he would switch them to do another, to showcase another application of the iPhone. So it's like, Once they go to market, they'll work. However, right now, I can only get these things to do one thing at a time. And so he's having to switch iPhones without people realizing it. Like kept setting it down and picking up another one, you know. It's that trickery, right? It's that fucking, you know, he's being so sly, and, you know, it's sort of unethical. I think I think Ms. Joanna Hoffman is right. In that it's not just boring. But again, that's something that really happened. And I think since this movie came out well after that, is that I don't know if that's what happened with the Macintosh, if they did have to run it on a higher processor. But it is absolutely true that they would flub or mislead, you know, to showcase a product, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. Because to be honest, the only thing I remember about the iPhone launch, and I'm pretty sure this is the one thing that most people remember, is that Steve made a call to like a local pizza place and acted like he was going to order a bunch of peaches for everyone. And then it was just like a prank call.
Oh, my God.
I
don't remember that.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been staged too, but you know, you can look up the footage. But yeah, he was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna need like 300 pizzas, and he's like, no, I'm just kidding, and then like hang up, and sure the person at that.
And I'll tell you this: that iPhone can only make phone calls. The one that he used.
Well, you know, I've got an original iPhone right over there.
Yeah, you do. Know? That is pretty cool.
That works.
Yeah,
but yeah, you know, it is interesting that, again, kind of what we've been saying is that there are, and I love that they're using these actual factual historical things and just tweaking it ever so slightly. And like, again, like with the Next launch, like, yeah, Next was a complete failure. But I like what they present in the film, which is that Steve knew it was going to be a failure, mm-hmm. just so Apple could come running back to him. Like, and I like that, you know, it shows how determined he was. Like, no, they need me.
Right. It shows like a methodical nature of his decision making, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, a little nefarious, but whatever, it worked for him, right? And it worked for his people. Whoever you want to bring on. Again, this movie's just great. And you're right. Taking things that are historically accurate, but placing them in different contexts and presenting them in different ways to tell this through line story and in these three acts, I think is just, it's innovative and it's genius. And I really like it. It disrupts, you know, what, you know, Steve Jobs was, I guess, a technical term would be a disruptor, right? In the mm-hmm. Technology space, this is sort of a disruption with biographies, right? In a biopic, which Sorkin is great at. So I hope he keeps doing it because he's very good at it. Who knows what he's doing next? I don't, but I'm sure whatever it is, it's awesome. So
yeah, I agree, man. Yeah, the movie is fantastic. God, it's just so good. It's so good. Very insightful words, I know. But, well, Jeremy, are you ready to wrap up?
I am. The movie, of course, I can't recommend it enough. I've seen it a ton of times. It's almost comfort watching to me because I love the rhythm of the dialogue. Mm-hmm. Something that I go to Sorkin for a lot is just rhythm of dialogue. It's soothing in a way because I just like hearing people talk and not really, you know, like, it's not really what they're saying, it's how they're saying it in a way. And mm-hmm. just the conversations that he writes are so dynamic and they're so unusual. Like, I remember seeing like advertisements for the Masterclass stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he had one and his was, listen, no one ever in the history of speaking has anyone started a sentence with the word damn it. Okay. But his characters do, right? So it's a way for him to show that, listen, like, you don't have to write the way people talk. You can write however you want, right? If it sounds mm-hmm. good. And if it's dynamic enough, or if it makes sense within the context of what you're writing. And you don't have to focus solely on the reality of how people speak or how people interact, which I think is a great example and a good metaphor for how he writes biopics and biographies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't say better myself, because I've seen The Social Network. I didn't realize he wrote it, which now it makes all the more sense.
Yeah.
He's the one who wrote it. Especially with the one line that stands out is when we meet Justin Timberlake's character Sean.
Oh yeah,
the guy who made Napster, and Dakota Johnson's all like, well, Sean so and so invented Napster. I invented Napster. Like, you know, it's very, yeah. Couldn't have said it better myself, dude. But so, buddy.
Yeah.
What are we talking about next week?
Okay. Next week, we are discussing the 2001 Alfonso Cuarón coming of age classic Y Tu Mama También.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited. Yeah. It's right there.
Yep.
Right next to my Wally. Oh, so excited.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like we've been building to this movie for the full lifespan of the podcast. Because I feel like back in season one, you were talking about this movie.
It's great. It's a great movie. Yeah.
And then, you know, so of course I'm excited for Alfonso Cuarón. But then, you know, more recently, Gael Garcia Bernal, just recently was in the Criterion Closet picking out some of his films, and he picked out Y Tu Mama También, and I just love what he said, which is, this movie will make you horny.
Yeah,
he's like, movies don't make you horny anymore. This one will make you horny, and it's just, I'm like, dude, you've already made the sale, dog. Like, it's all like, I'm gonna see this movie now.
Also stars Maribel Verdú, who is in mm-hmm. Pan's Labyrinth, which we did earlier this season.
And more recently, and I apologize to everyone, but more recently she was in that god awful Flash movie.
Was she really?
Yeah, she was Barry Allen's mom, and she was completely underutilized. Now seeing Pan's Labyrinth, she was fully underutilized.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I didn't know that. In the Flash, yeah, that's so bizarre. Does he have an accent?
Well,
okay.
Yep. Cool. Yeah. Andy Muschietti like didn't even. I don't think he even told her like try to do an American accent.
Yeah, because I think she's from Spain.
Yeah. Well, and then.
Yeah, she's from Madrid. Look at that.
Hang on, everyone. Before we close out the show. She's married to Ron Livingston in the movie because they couldn't get Billy Crudup back for this movie. And so Ron Livingston is Barry's dad. And it's just like knowing that she's from Madrid and she has an accent. It's like you chose to marry Ron Livingston.
No shade to Ron Livingston. We love Office Space.
No. Yeah. We love Ron Livingston, but he also is very underutilized in The Flash.
Kind of seems like everybody was.
That movie was fine. It was way too overhyped. I don't know what the fuck kind of movies Tom Cruise had been seeing, but that was not the quote unquote greatest superhero movie ever made.
Yeah.
It was fine.
Yeah.
But all right, everyone. We hope you enjoyed this episode on Steve Jobs, and we will see you next week for Y Tu Mama También.